This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you in our first hour today. I want to get into what the Koch brothers are really up to and what the corporate and right-wing agenda for America is. And in the second hour, how this is affecting trade and privacy and what's going on with these. But let's start out with America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringofireradio.com. And Pap, welcome.
Tom, how are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us today. So you've been looking at the price of oil?
Yeah, I think it's an important story. You know, people pull up to the gas station. They put in fuel that costs $2.50 a gallon. And they say, great, but nobody is analyzing what's happening here. I mean, you know, we all want a deal. We all want to say, yeah, that's a great deal. But you also have to kind of ask questions. You have to be interested enough to maybe ask tough questions. Why is this happening? And so the theories that are out there, I think, need discussion. I mean, the most prominent theories are that fracking has helped create this glut of oil on the market. That's one part of it. The slowing Chinese economy and uptick in alternative energy, those are things, of course, that figure in. The American public's buying more fuel-efficient cars. They're driving less. And very important is that OPEC is sabotaging both the fracking industry and, this is what everybody's not, the move to alternative energy. By creating this glut on the market. When people don't have to pay a lot for fuel, they go out and it's like they have the memory of a gnat. They go out and they buy the big gas-guzzling SUVs until the next oil crisis. But if you spend some time online, you're going to find endless op-eds about this issue. But it's almost, if you ask 10 people, what do you think is going on here? They don't even have an opinion.
Yeah. There's one other possibility, too. Back in March of last year, there were a series of articles in the New York Times over about a week and a half period that we talked about at some length on the air at that time, where Dodd-Frank's commodities trading provision kicked in February or March of 2014. And that month, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, there was like four out of the five big banks sold or dissolved their commodities trading divisions. And so, you know, and Bernie Sanders has been saying 40% of the price of oil and gas right now is being skimmed off the top by the banks speculating.
Yeah.
So what I was suggesting on the air was that, you know, okay, most of these contracts, the highest percentage of these contracts are 6-month contracts, and then the rest of them are 12, you know, by and large, 6-month and 12-month. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens to the price of commodities 6 months from now and what happens to the profitability of these the big New York banks. And sure enough, 6 months later, the price of oil started to collapse as these contracts started to unwind. And I don't know if you've noticed, but in the last two quarters, the banks have not been profitable.
Yeah.
Or as profitable.
Well, that was a good projection. I've heard the theory out there. To add to that, Tom, think about this. The fracking industry is all pumped up with, I think it's like, $200 or $300 billion in bonds. Okay.
Yeah, the junk
in order
bonds.
To frack the bond, you've got to have money for the fracking industry. So are we now going to see another bubble? Are we going to see another tech bubble where all this bond money is out there and they just simply can't make the payment on the
bond?
Or
are they going to default on those bonds and will that bring down the economy?
That's exactly the question.
Because that's what happened with junk bonds just before the last big stock market crash in 2008, was the junk bond market collapsed about 3 months before the larger market did.
Right. And if you build that much money around fracking and you've got OPEC trying to destroy fracking, there's no question that's what they're doing. They just want to, you know, they want to crash fracking and they can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, the numbers don't add up. If you think about this, fracking needs a 75 they need to make $75 per barrel just to break even.
Right.
Now, right now, you have oil that, you know, is going to be, even if it starts rising, it's 50 to 60 a barrel. They still don't break even. And so you've got these fracking sites that the other part of the problem is they have a 3-year usability life. In other words, you get most of your oil the first year and then that's it. And then the frackers say, well, what about natural gas? Well, even with natural gas, if you take a look at it, natural gas, $13 is what it used to get per BTU per million, and that's dropped to $3. So, I mean, it's all lining up for exactly what you just said, and that is some bit of a crash. And of course, the OPEC group would be delighted to see that. And I think that's kind of where we're headed with this. But I'm always amazed at people not saying, well, what's happening here? They go to the gas station, they fill up, as if there's no tomorrow, as if they say, well, okay, I'm going to go out and buy that big SUV because things are really great now, without ever understanding what's really happening.
Right. And meanwhile, now we're seeing, you know, all this evidence coming out that maybe the big dog in OPEC, Saudi Arabia, was backing Al-Qaeda before 9/11. And that's including, you know, Mousawi named the guy who was the second largest stockholder in Fox News up until the middle of last year, Prince Talawid or whatever you say.
Tom, Ron Motley, who's been a friend of mine for a very long time, he's the lawyer who initiated the lawsuit against the Saudi Arabia for 9/11.
Wow.
Yeah, That's the one where all this stuff is coming out. That's exactly right. So Ron Motley, he died last year, as a matter of fact, and the stories that he would tell about what was going on, investigators that would be sent into Saudi Arabia that would disappear, they simply didn't know where the hell they ended up. The documents are almost overwhelming, Tom, and we've ignored Saudi Arabia's involvement in this, and now finally, witness who has no reason to say what he's saying is saying, yeah, absolutely, Saudi Arabia not only was part of the financing, they were part of the plan. They were part of the infrastructure to kill 3,000 innocent Americans in the Twin Towers. And you know, that juxtaposed with the picture opportunities that we've seen over the years with George Bush holding hands and going through the ceremonial kisses, and now Obama declaring what a great loss it was to us to have the king die. It's a little nauseating, really, once you start seeing the backstories to all this.
Yeah. Meanwhile, UBS, the United Bank of Switzerland, I think that acronym stands for, is avoiding taxes. What's the deal here?
Yeah. Well, they're not only avoiding taxes, Tom. What they're doing is they're attracting very high-end investors, the billionaire investment group. And they're telling them, if you come to do business with us, we have a special plan for you. We're going to give you something called bearer securities. Now, bearer securities is something, it's not money, it simply is this certificate, like an old bearer bond. You show the certificate and all of a sudden you get cash for it. Well, the problem is that you can use those bearer certificates. They made them illegal in the United States because they found out there were all types of IRS scams that they were being used for. The money couldn't be followed. So all of a sudden the Treasury was losing millions and millions of dollars with these tax scams. Well, UBS didn't just come up with the idea. They've marketed the idea very aggressively. They've understood that United States made it illegal, and they understood why. You understand, in 2009, UBS had to pay almost an $800 million fine for the same kind of conduct, trying to protect billionaire and millionaire investors with them, or people who did banking with them. And that was their sale, Tom. It's not just this something they did on the side. They said, come to us and we'll help you cheat taxes. Wow. That's what this is really uncovering right now.
Wow. Well, Swiss banks and tax cheats, they kind of go in the same sentence. That's an amazing story. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer and host of Ring of Fire Radio on weekends on many of our stations. Ring of Fire Radio. RingofFireRadio.com is the website. Pap, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be sure to check out Mike Papantonio's website, ringoffireradio.com. And welcome back. Dr. Papantonio, you're still on the line with us.
I am. How are you doing,
Tom? Okay, good. So what's happening this Sunday at noon Eastern time on Ring of Fire TV or Ring of Fire Radio on Free Speech TV here?
Yeah, we've got a great lineup. We've got Howard Nations. He's going to talk about how the Republican attacks on the IRS are intentional. They're intended to prevent the agency from doing its job, specifically for going after their donors. And that's benefiting the GOP tremendously. Hmm. We're going to talk about the, we'll talk about the DEA and how they're using license plate tracking, a license plate number to keep tabs on you in all kinds of ways. And the reason they're doing it, Tom, is because they can confiscate your property even without you committing a crime. They can have suspicion that you committed a crime. You can fall into a certain profile, and the government can come get your cars, your boats, your houses, whatever they. It's almost a Wild West, no limits kind of confiscation.
It's a kleptocracy. System.
It is, and the shift. The interesting thing is, the burden shifts to the person who's lost their car to show that we weren't doing anything wrong. It's not that the government has to show that they were. They have, the person whose car that was just driven away, they have to show it wasn't being.
And didn't,
wasn't being
didn't this program start out fairly limited? Like it was, they were allowed to do license plate readers, automatic license plate readers, and build a database at the Mexican border. And that was what it was originally set up for. And then they said, hey, we've got authority. We'll just do it everywhere in the country.
We got a great way to make money is what it was.
Really?
Seth Katz is going to talk about how corporations are using psychological tactics to what they're doing to really win public minds on critical issues, how they go about, what's the steps they use, how does an Ogilvy group, a PR group out of Washington or Europe, how do they come here and change our minds about issues that absolutely have a major impact on our lives, and they typically are successful. Richard Eskow is going to talk about the zero, he's going to talk about the Koch brothers' assault on green energy, and how it's an all-out assault, how it's very well planned, and how they seem to be picking up momentum in going after alternative energy stories. Wes Bowden is going to talk about the chemical giant Monsanto, and you've covered this story many times, but we've taken off on your coverage, and we're going to talk about how Americans are in such big danger from GMO products. And this huge resistance from government and the huge money coming in to convince the American public that it's just fine, A, not to label products with GMO, and B, that GMO products are completely safe. The scientists they've paid a lot of money to say that to, how have they hired them, where do they get them, and why are these people who work at credible universities that know they're lying about it come forward and lie anyway? How much does that cost?
Yeah. And how much more Roundup glyphosate is on the food that you know they use GMO, because GMO is to make the plants resistant to the herbicide. We had this doc on here the other day who was saying that she thinks that the glyphosate, the Roundup, is what's causing this epidemic of celiac disease. It's killing off people's gut bacteria.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it's amazing how they've just run without any type of roadblocks at all. Monsanto just seems to, they have the best lobbyists and the best PR people in the world, and they've put them to really good use on this case.
Yeah. And they did an incredible, revolving door when George Herbert Walker Bush was, when he was president, where they put their guy in at the USDA or FDA, whichever it was.
Oh, Obama has him too. Obama has him all over his administration.
Oh, amazing. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com, the website. Ring of Fire right here on Free Speech TV every Sunday at noon and throughout the week. Thank you, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to see you. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Peter in Atlanta, Michigan? Is there an Atlanta in Michigan, Peter? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yes, it's the other Atlanta.
I was born and grew up in Michigan. I lived there the first 27 years of my life. I have no recollection of an Atlanta. Where is it?
That's the beauty of it all. We're up in between Gaylord and Alpine up in Northeast.
Okay.
And, we get about 13,000 in our whole county.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's great.
Well, say, Tom, concerning, I heard you talking about the Saudi Arabia, flooding the market with the oil, therefore driving the price down,
mm-hmm.
In combat against the fracking industry. And I am taking that, I'm accepting that theory and thought. But something that kind of goes a little bit further is that, John McCain, when he was just over there with his senator buddies there talking,
With Lindsey Graham.
Hopefully negotiating the ISIS situation. Is that I have, come from the conspiracy theory era, And I'm just waiting for some news to come out that McCain and the senator buddies have been negotiating with Saudi Arabia to persuade them to drop the price or to higher the price of the crude, so that way our fossil fuel people here in the States will be able to again to profit again, like as they were.
I don't know about that, Peter. What I do know is that McCain and Lindsey Graham reached out. This is at the early days a year ago, you know, in the early stages of the war against Syria and or against Assad in Syria. And they reached out to some Saudi billionaires and asked that money be given to Sunni rebels in Syria to fight the Syrian regime. That money was given. And the group that, apparently was created as a consequence of that, we refer to as ISIS or ISIL now. And and there's some considerable evidence that you can track that right back to John McCain and Lindsey Graham. Peter, thank you for the call. It's a great one. I want to get into my rant for this hour. It's and we'll pick up some of your calls and things on some of these issues. But this is astonishing. From the District Sentinel, the District Sentinel, you know, we live in D.C., so you don't have to, or we watch D.C., so you don't have to. Their slogan, it's a news co-op. Sam Knight wrote this. And the headline is, leak shows sweeping trade deal could be used to privatize healthcare. And we're not just talking about in the United States. We're talking about all around the world. This was published yesterday in an international nonprofit called the Associated Whistleblower Press, which released a leaked paper from the trade negotiations between the United States and EU member states. And this is not the TPP, the SHAFTA. This is a whole nother deal that's being worked out with the European states. And this is pretty astonishing. The paper bemoans the lack of market mechanisms, Sam Knight writes, in determining how health services are allocated. Are you listening carefully? There, you know, this paper that was produced by this trade group that is, you know, got another trade deal for us. Hey, another wonderful trade deal. They're saying one of the big problems is that healthcare isn't subject to market forces. Why? Because individual countries are providing free healthcare to their citizens, and there's no profit motive in free healthcare. So it's not subject to market forces. Instead, it's cheap and it works. Anyhow, what they say is the health sector has played only a very minor role, and they misspelled minor, in international trade because the healthcare services is funded. Apparently whoever wrote this paper never took second grade grammar, because the healthcare services is funded and provided by state or welfare organizations and is virtually no interest for foreign competitors due to the lack of market-oriented scope of activity or for activity. Other than the nature of the healthcare sectors, there are also regulatory and structural access barriers suppressing the potential volume of trade in health services. What they're calling for is investor-state dispute settlement mechanisms that could allow companies to claim that a policy change impacted adversely its profitability so that the government can be sued. Got this? It is so important that we understand the end game here. The end game of the right-wing billionaires who are funding politics in the United States, the end game of the right-wing billionaires and transnational corporations who are imposing austerity on European countries, secondary and tertiary European countries, the end game of the funders of the Paul Ryans and John Boehners and Mitch McConnells of the world, certainly Jeb Bush and friends. I'm increasingly thinking the Republican ticket is going to be Jeb Bush and Scott Walker for VP. We'll see. But in any case, all of these guys are funded by basically the same right-wing billionaires, and their end game is to squeeze a profit out of anything that moves, right? Anything that is being done by government right now that can be flipped into a profit-earning potential should be. That's their mantra, because then you have market forces, and the market is magic, you know. Now, this is a religious belief. This is a fantasy. The idea that, you know, your local water company has been supplying water to you for years and years and years. It's owned by your city in most of America. And the idea that if you bring somebody in who's got a profit motive attached to this thing, they can make a buck off it, and therefore you'll get better water. No, it typically doesn't work out that way. Typically, when you privatize public natural monopolies, water, septic, roads, what you do is you raise the cost of them to everybody, and you increase the profits to a small group of investors. Period. And that's what these guys are all about. Is how can we skim money off the top? That's entirely it. Now, meanwhile, in Greece, Alexis Tsipras is back home from Northern Europe. He's the new Greek prime minister. And he got nothing. He went to the Germans, principally, and the French and the EU, and went to Brussels. But what he said was, basically, we're not taking orders from you. He said, Greece won't be under orders anymore, especially orders through emails. Greece is no longer the miserable partner who listens to its lectures to do its homework. Greece has its own voice. So people are starting to stand up now to the oligarchs.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
The biggest oligarch in Europe is, of course, Germany as a representative of the rest of the oligarchs. And Greece is saying, no thanks. Bad and the very, very nudie, astertionly ugly, the good. Bill de Blasio, New York City mayor, added to his progressive bona fides Tuesday by calling for $15 an hour minimum wage in his State of the State address. Or the State of the City address, I guess it would be. Under de Blasio's plan, New York City's minimum wage would rise to $13 by 2016 and then rise with inflation so that it would hit $15 an hour by 2019. If the city council goes along with the mayor's plan, Big Apple would join Seattle as the only two cities in the country with a $15 an hour minimum wage. When New Yorkers chose Bill de Blasio to succeed Michael Bloomberg as mayor, they hoped they were choosing a more progressive future. By pushing for the nation's highest minimum wage, Mayor de Blasio is proving once again that they made the right choice. The bad. Senator Rand Paul. In a recent email to supporters, the Kentucky senator blasted Common Core education requirements, saying that they were filled with, quote, anti-American propaganda and revisionist history that ignores the faith of our founders, end quote. Sounds pretty bad, right? Well, here's the thing. Common Core doesn't actually have any history or social studies requirements whatsoever. It does make students read the Declaration of Independence, Lincoln's second inaugural address, and a few other seminal historical documents, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who thinks that the preamble to the Constitution is anti-American propaganda. In other words, once again, Rand Paul is full of it. And the very, very ugly Robert Thrivers. The Rutgers University professor is under fire for comments he made about billionaire Jeffrey Epstein, who is alleged to have run an underage sex ring for the rich and powerful. Thrivers, a friend of Epstein who received grant money from one of his foundations, one of Epstein's foundations, told Reuters Monday that the crimes Epstein is accused of aren't that bad because, quote, by the time they're 14 or 15, teenage girls are like grown women were 60 years ago. In other words, Epstein couldn't help himself because underage girls are just too attractive these days. It's very, very ugly. Welcome back. So let me just kind of wrap this all up. I want to just bring this back around to what's going on right now. What's going on, probably a reasonable question is, how do we talk about this? I mean, I've been using the word fascism, the merger of state and corporate interests. But too many people think that fascism means Nazism. Should we be using corporatism? Should we be using oligarchy? Senator Sanders likes to use the phrase oligarchy, and he talks about the oligarchs. And I think that's a great phrase. The reality is that the oligarchs are taking over the United States. They put a very, very sophisticated political messaging machine into the low population Midwestern states where with a very small amount of money, you can turn public opinion your way. And over the course of the last three decades, flipped those states to hard Republican, Wyoming, Oklahoma, these kind of states. And And they worked real hard on New Hampshire, although it goes back and forth as, you know, Boston, as it becomes increasingly a bedroom community to Boston. But this has worked very well for them. 20 million more people voted for Democrats for the U.S. Senate, yet the U.S. Senate is controlled by Republicans because they, you know, they had this strategic 40-year plan. 5 million more people voted for Democrats in the House of Representatives, but House of Representatives is controlled by Republicans. Once again, a very strategic plan for gerrymandering starting in 2010 in ways that are arguably skirting right around the edge of legality and certainly flying in the face of constitutionality. But the end game here is to reduce the American working class to poverty. Now, I realize that sounds pretty draconian. I mean, holy cow, why would any oligarch want the American working class to be poor? It's a pretty straightforward logical process. Go back to 1951 when Russell Kirk published The Conservative Mind. And, you know, he starts out the book by talking about how Sir Edmund Burke, back in the 1790s, when Thomas Paine went over and spent 2 weeks at Edmund Burke's home on his way to France and ended up so angry by Burke's right-wing rhetoric and perspective that Thomas Paine wrote The Rights of Man as a rebuttal to Sir Edmund Burke. Sir Edmund Burke, the father of modern conservative thought, a Brit who actually supported, ultimately, the American Revolution, but he was a conservative. And he said, for example, famously, and I'm paraphrasing from memory, but this is pretty close. He said, "It does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in as servile a profession as that of hairdresser or candlemaker, tallowmaker. But it does society considerable violence if such a man, the hairdresser or the candlemaker, is allowed to participate in the processes of government." In other words, to vote. But that does violence to society. This, you go back to 1951, The Conservative Mind, and what Russell Kirk laid out was the conservative concern in 1951. This was just a couple of years before Elvis. And Elvis began to validate their concerns. And then the Beatles came along, and I just blew it right out the door. And that is that if the middle class got strong, if Americans were not afraid, if kids could go to college without fear that, you know, some anvil was going to fall on their head, an anvil like a lousy credit score or a huge amount of debt, or getting kicked out of school means you'll never get into another one. If kids could go to school with a high level of freedom and security, which is what we were doing in the United States in the 50s as a result of the GI Bill, and free public universities, like in the entire state of California and scattered all over the United States, New York University and others, that if kids could go to school for free, if people with just a high school diploma, God forbid, just a high school diploma, could get a job that would allow them to raise a family and be a single wage earner, breadwinner, that if that was to happen, if people who only graduated high school, maybe didn't even graduate high school, were able to make in today's money the equivalent of $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, which is what people were making back then. Individual income back in the 1970s, early 1980s, before Reaganomics, individual worker income was the equivalent of around $26,000 a year, was around $26,000 back then in those dollars. Family income was that, and that's the equivalent of around $40,000 or $50,000 in today's money. What has happened is that household income is around $50,000, but individual worker income is still around $26,000. What used to be a household of one working person is now a household of two and a half working people. So what they've done is they've disempowered the middle class. I mean, this is all about creating a feudal, F-E-U-D-A-L system, a system where the oligarchs basically own everything. They own society. They own you. They own me. They own the house that you live in. They own everything. And if we stand up, if we speak out, if we attend a demonstration, if we get arrested for civil disobedience, and we're 22 years old, our life is over. Right? That arrest record disqualifies a person in many states from voting. It disqualifies them from many jobs. It disqualifies them from most government jobs, which is 15-20% of the economy. This, so you look at that, then you look at all the ways that they're trying to make sure that now that they've got the middle class on its knees, now that these oligarchs, these billionaires, have the middle class begging for help and saying, you know, please, please, you know, we'll do anything. We'll work at McDonald's. We'll work at Walmart. We'll work three jobs, please. Now that the oligarchs have the middle class, you know, begging, the next step is to make sure that the middle class never votes. Or the working class, the lower middle class. How do you prevent these folks from voting? Well, they've got a very simple strategy. Number one, particularly people of color, set up a criminal justice system that disproportionately targets them, and then marry that with laws in the states that say that after you've been through the criminal justice system, you cannot vote for the rest of your life. So states that should be voting Democratic, states in the southeastern United States, for example, have, you know, as much 10, 15, 20% of their African-American populations are, you know, ineligible to vote. Hundreds of thousands of people, which keeps these states under the control of the right-wing white power structure. And now in Ohio, you got John Husted, Husted, I don't know how you say his name. He's the Secretary of State. He says, undocumented immigrants, because of Obama's letting these young people stay, the dreamers in this country, they're going to get driver's licenses, and then they're going to show up to vote. Right. He was able to find 17 cases of non-citizens who voted in the 2012 election. That's 0.0003% of the population. And for that, he wants to go into communities of color and just disenfranchise everybody.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We've got to make sure that everybody who even looks remotely Hispanic or darker can't vote because one of them might not be a citizen. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's see. Darby in Darby, Montana? Really?
Yes.
Hi. You're named after your town or the other way around?
No, the other way around. Lived here for years. My folks lived here for years. Wow. And you are our superhero.
Well, thank you.
God for you. But why I'm calling today, Tom, is I don't think the American people are aware that George W. Bush and his father should have ever been president of the United States. And why I'm saying that is because Prescott Bush was dyed-in-the-wool Nazi, and he gave millions and millions to Hitler when he was, you know.
Well, Darby, I think to say that Prescott Bush was a dyed-in-the-wool Nazi would be an exaggeration. What he was a dyed-in-the-wool bankster. And as a bankster, yeah, if he could make money giving money to the Nazis, which is what he did when he was at Brown Brothers, later Brown Brothers Harriman, that's what he did during World War II. He was funding the Nazis, and Roosevelt busted him for that, and debated whether or not to prosecute him, ultimately decided not to. But that's what. But it wasn't because he loved Nazis or he loved Hitler. It's because he loved money.
I think he did because he built Auschwitz. And if you get on your computer and look, he built Auschwitz. And there were two survivors from Auschwitz that sued the Bush family.
Wow. You know, his money may have been used to build Auschwitz. But I have a real hard time believing that anybody, any American, knew what was going on with Auschwitz and said, gee, I think I'll help this out.
It's all there where you can read it, and I was astounded. I think I first became aware of it in something I read. So I looked it up again the other day, and the people that tried to sue the Bush family, somehow the Bushes got the law changed where they couldn't be sued, but I think they are going to sue to the tune of $2 billion.
Yeah.
And it's just so scary, and now now Jeb wants to run from office, and it just makes my blood run cold. That, and also your Congress. I always think of the Congress right now being anti-American, too, so...
Yeah, I think that especially the folks in Congress who are pushing for free trade deals, you know, to further eviscerate the American middle class and hand more power to the oligarchs, the Republicans in Congress who want to disenfranchise more voters. I mean, there's a large chunk of it. Darby, thank you for the call, and you know, thank you for your concern.
Thank you so much for taking it.
My pleasure. And thanks for watching us there on Free Speech TV in Darby, Montana. How cool to have your town named after you or vice versa. That's great. Back to Prescott Bush, who at one point was a U.S. senator, by the way, as I recall. Prescott Bush was making money on the Nazis. And that's the thing that we all have to understand. I mean, you sit around and go, you know, well, how can the Koch brothers fund groups that deny climate change? Because they make money, converting fossil fuels into carbon dioxide in the air. They make money doing it. And their first loyalty is not to the United States. It's not to, apparently, I shouldn't say this specifically of the Kochs. I'd say in general, the billionaire class, the industrial class, their first loyalty is not to the United States. It's not to the world. It's not to the human race. It's to themselves. It's to money. They're serving mammon, period. Their own. 10 minutes before that. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Trey in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Trey, what's on your mind?
How you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call. One of the things I was wondering, and maybe you can clarify this more, I've been reading more, a little bit more on feudalism.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what the end game of this, of these Republicans and like the Rand Paul types, is feudalism? Or whoever's got the power, the money, the guns can beat up on the people that don't have it?
That's exactly right. And you have the lords and ladies who basically don't just own your labor. They own everything. They own your home. They own you, basically. And you know, this is a new dressed up kind of feudalism where the ownership is through the process of debt rather than through just naked ownership. But you can equally go to jail just like you could in Sherwood Forest for not, you know, if you didn't, you know, catch rabbits for the king or whatever, you go to jail. Now, you know, if you don't catch rabbits for your employer and you end up in debt, we now have debtors' prisons in the United States.
Yep, that's true. I just wanted to get that clarified. I've been doing a little bit more research on that, and that's what it seems like to me. So,
thanks
for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome. I have a whole chapter in my book Screwed about this, about feudalism, what feudalism is, where it comes from, and how that really is the end game. I think you'll find it interesting. Lynn in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Lynn, thanks for listening to KBQ. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to call about the oil companies,
right.
And they are really up to something because. In New Mexico, we've had oil wells capped for about 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there's an oil boom here now. It's just crazy. And they don't mention it much on the news at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing because why didn't they uncap these oil wells when the gas prices were $4 a gallon?
Right.
And another thing, I spoke at two different meetings in Lybrook, New Mexico, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, against the oil pipeline that was going to go through Chaco Canyon, and there was an oil executive there, and he also used to be a BLM executive. So I found that very interesting how our whole country is selling us out to the oil companies. And
it's the revolving door. Henry Wallace said this so well back in 1944. He said they want to combine the power of the marketplace with the power of government, which is what creates and regulates the marketplace, so that controlling both, they can keep, Henry Wallace said, keep the common man in eternal subjection. A less florid way of saying that would be they can make sure that, you know, laborers don't have an opportunity to unionize, that they're terrified and frightened and working on the edge of survival. And, you know, the Walton family ends up owning more wealth than the, you know, the bottom half of America. So, yeah. Lynn, I don't know about the uncapped wells. That sounds fascinating. Is this a result of fracking that they've taken wells and by fracking them?
These wells have been there for 30 or 40 years, and they just decided to uncap them right now. And what's going on also is the fact that they have like little camps around each oil well, and these men have been raping the native women also.
Yeah, so, I've heard about that. They can go on to the Native American reservations, rape the Native American women, and then leave the reservation, and the tribal police can't go after them because they're off the reservation. And the state police won't go after them because the women are supposed to report to the tribal police. There's a weird catch 22 in here that is creating some serious problems. I've read several articles about that. Lynn, thanks for bringing it up, and thanks for the call. Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Hey, Matt, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom. What you were talking about with the gentleman from Cincinnati a moment ago was the recreation of the debt peonage system.
Yes.
And this was the system that was used through much of colonial South America as a means of control. First, it was outright slavery, but then it was very much a debt peonage system to, you know, maintain feudalism during a period that was...
Well, it's still going on down there, Matt, and it's happening here now.
Well, exactly. I mean, everyone is in debt. I'm in debt up to my eyeballs, and most of America is, and we're working multiple jobs.
But yeah.
I think really the end game, Tom, and I think this is probably in agreement with what you're saying, Tom DeLay sort of let the cat out of the bag a few years ago. He was over at the Marianas in 1996, I believe. And after he came back, and the Marianas was a place where actual chattel slavery was practiced, I suspect probably still is. But he said that the Marianas, the type of capitalism over there, was a model for America.
Right.
And I think what's happening on a worldwide level for the super rich is they're pushing for not just a de facto recreation of the aristocracy, the kind of thing that existed before the French Revolution, but the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much in their grasp. They don't need any more money. They don't need any more power. I mean, any more land or whatnot. They already got everything, but they do have still actual laws and institutions like democracy, or at least the vestiges of democracy, that are still a check on their power.
Yeah.
But they're in a position now, because they're such a tiny group, just as was the case prior to the French Revolution and all the other revolutions that followed, to control everything. And they can see that. They don't need anything more. I mean, they're set for generations and generations and generations. And I think the end game is really a reinstitution of aristocracy.
Well, yes, it is. And there's nuance to that. And that's what I was talking about yesterday when I went off on that long rant about Singapore. It's aristocracy, the aristocracy of the rich, using, as you correctly point out, a debt peonage system. But the end result of that is basically creating a landed gentry, is creating a super class, a royal class without the trappings of royalty, but because it is a hereditary class, it pretty much is the royal class. Did you see what Paris Hilton's younger brother did yesterday?
No, he was
on a British American flight. He's 20 years old. He was on a British flight, or what is it, the British Airways flight, and he was yelling at the customers, calling them peons. Told the flight attendant, "I own you." You know, when I believe he got arrested for all this, but it's like, you know, is he going to make that stick against somebody in the Hilton family, really? And it's just, you know, the whole you know, landed gentry thing is just bizarre. Matt, thank you for the call. Matt's right. And the conservative issue, if you read The Conservative Mind, you go back to Russell Kirk, you go back to the beginning of the conservative movement in the United States, the conservative issue is maintaining social stability. I'll share more with you on that right after the break.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Wanted to get into some of the... This is a somewhat different issue. We can continue to talk about, you know, the end game of the Republican or the conservative strategy. We really should call it the conservative strategy because the conservative movement has taken over the Republican Party. There used to be progressive Republicans. Dwight Eisenhower arguably was one of them. Teddy Roosevelt was certainly one of them. President Taft was arguably one of them. But, you know, by and large, they don't exist anymore. So the conservative movement has taken over the Republican Party. And the Republican Party has thus become the wholly owned subsidiary of the oligarchs, the billionaires, and the transnational corporations, because they took over the conservative movement first. Now, just consider the logic of this. The sequence. In 71, Lewis Powell said to his buddies in business, Lewis Powell, tobacco lawyer in Virginia here, and he writes this letter to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and says, it's time to get politically active. We have not been politically active. It's always been considered unpatriotic or inappropriate for a business to engage in politics, but it's time. Because there are threats to business coming from people like Ralph Nader and Rachel Carlson, and he named them by name. Silent Spring and Unsafe at Any Speed. These books have started consumer movements, and combined with the labor movement, they are working to constrain the economic activity, i.e. the profitability of big corporations. We've got to do something about that. And he was particularly concerned, of course, about the tobacco industry that he had been a lawyer for most of his life. So Lewis Powell started that bandwagon rolling in 71, saying we need to create some think tanks. Heritage, Cato, all that stuff came out of that. We need to put conservatives on the bench, the Federalist Society. We need to have our own media, Fox so-called News, right-wing talk radio, the Rush Limbaugh Show. We need to own our own politicians. So put Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court in 1976, have him write the decision in the Buckley case saying, hey, if a billionaire decides that they want to buy a politician, that's considered free speech under the Constitution. It had never been that way before, but you know, starting in 76, that was the new American way. So, you know, we can continue talking about that, but I want to go to a second step here. And that is, you know, we're talking about the instruments of oppression. Jefferson talked about how the principal instrument of oppression in a society, in a capitalist society, would be debt. And he talked about how, you know, if we give into this, if we live in debt, if we basically become the property of the banksters, then one day we shall be content to be working 16 hours a day, hammering the rivets onto the necks of our fellow workers. I'm paraphrasing, but you can find the quote. So what are the other instruments of oppression? Right, the principal one, obviously, is debt. And what we've seen over the last 35 years, Reaganomics, is this multi-trillion dollar, best estimates, somewhere between $8 and $30 trillion transfer of wealth from the working class and the middle class into the pockets of the top 1%, principally the pockets of the top 1/100th of 1%, both in the U.S. and around the world. That's what Thatcheronomics, Reaganomics, austerity-nomics, whatever you want to call it, that's what that has brought us. But what other instruments of oppression are there? What I see on the horizon, and that scares the hell out of me, and frankly, I should probably write my next book on this, is the rise of authoritarian capitalism. Authoritarian capitalism was perfected, you know, arguably was perfected by the British in the 18th century, in the 1700s, where, you know, you had the British East India Company owning the world, and you had the government of Great Britain using the East India Company as a tool to do so, and you had maximum wage laws in England during the Victorian era and before. You had maximum wage laws in the United Kingdom. Why would you cap wages? Why would you say, for the equivalent in the United States would be saying, instead of having a minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, we're going to have a maximum wage of $10 an hour. No, anybody who works, who does not have a college degree or some accreditation in some field, the maximum that they can earn is $10 an hour. Why would you do that? You do that so that you keep your working class poor, so they are disempowered and they can't challenge your power. Now, in addition to that, as capitalism becomes authoritarian capitalism, one of the things that really got developed in the 20th century is the idea of databases. Having all the information you can get on the individuals in society so that you can control them and destroy them when the time comes. Consider this. And, you know, again, I'm not saying that this is that Facebook is some Machiavellian thought control experiment, but it is a symptom of a larger problem that we have in our society, which is, you know, the old joke, if somebody offers you something for free, you're probably the product. That, you know, that Facebook is basically, and not just Facebook, this is, you know, right, virtually every business model now, these, you know, this is certainly the Google business model, this is to some extent the Amazon business model. Ever heard anything from Amazon and gotten it really cheap, and then all of a sudden you're getting all kinds of catalogs from the company that did the fulfillment? They were willing to sell that to you at break even or even a loss in order to get your name, because a name that's a real name, we know this person has a credit card, they buy things, that name can be sold over and over and over again, and suddenly you've got a mailbox full of junk mail. But it gets more perfidious. Lauren Williams, writing for the Center for American Progress, back on May 8th of last year: if you think your messages to your Facebook friends are private, think again. Social network has announced that it plans to look at your personal conversation. Now, this is your Facebook chat, which has now been spun off into its own app. They plan to look at your personal conversations as a way to make more profits from targeted advertising. They're all about data mining. Private messaging, Lauren writes, has become an incredibly popular feature, which nearly every top social media app centers itself around. In other words, not just Facebook. And then, you know, one of these folks who are Ramandi Darvalsula, PhD, a Los Angeles-based psychologist, told this writer, what people share via a private chat and what they share in a status update are vastly different. That's what makes personal conversations the very best place to get data, because it's uncensored. People are uninhibited online. They share their emotional ups and downs. They live tweet their childbirth. You know, this kind of thing pulls back another layer, exposing what truly makes one tick, to quote Lauren Williams at the Center for American Progress. So they can figure out, you know, what drugs you're using, legal or illegal, what, you know, what your life is like, what you like to eat, where you go. And now, on top of this just came out today, John Bohannon writing, over at sciencemag.org. Appear at a photo taken at a protest march, a gay bar, or an abortion clinic, and your friends might recognize you, but a machine probably won't, at least until now. But within the walled garden of Facebook, which contains by far the largest collection of personal photographs in the world, the technology for that facial recognition is beginning to blossom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, they say it's to protect your privacy, so, you know, well, I'll tell you more about that right after. Welcome back. Kenyatta in Redlands, California. Hey, Kenyatta, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to make three statements and ask you a question. The first statement is, you didn't say it. You were more diplomatic. I do believe Facebook is a Machiavellian thought control mechanism.
I think they're into making money. You know, owning and selling our information is one of the ways that they make money. But what's going to happen is somebody's going to come along who is interested in controlling us. And it might be a political party, it might be a company, it might just be an oligarch. And Facebook and Amazon and all these other companies are going to be making all this information available for sale, and they buy your information, now they own you.
Well, I think, you know, Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning have pretty much shed some light on that, and again, you know, you have stores where you just mentioned it. You have the card. You know, the steak is $12 without the card. It's $2 with the card. Of course, why am I going to spend the $10? But what do they find out when I use the card? And I do this repeatedly. They find out that I eat meat. They find out if I'm a vegetarian. They find out if I buy sanitary napkins or if I buy dog food.
Right.
You know. So.
Yep.
So
and then they can make a buck off you. But, you know, and that's all making a buck off you. Where it concerns me is, you know, this new facial recognition software and stuff like this is just tracking us. And they want to track us for a profit. I understand that. I do think that, though, however, that the purpose of government is to limit, to constrain the excesses of the marketplace. And nobody talks about that anymore. You know, nobody's talking about that. And that really should be one of the principal purposes of government. The marketplace is too strong.
I agree.
Okay, so
you mentioned the maintenance of or maintaining social stability with regard to the conservative strategy.
Right.
You know, I call that the quiet riot. You know, one of the questions I wanted to ask you about that is one of the components of that what I call the boogeyman syndrome. And this seems to be relatively new. I mean, it really came into the forefront after, of course, 9/11. But, you know, it seems like there is a concerted effort that I don't see taking place anywhere else on the globe in this country to keep the population afraid. The Al-Qaeda, ISIS. I remember the Ebola scare back in October. Oh, my goodness.
Which vanished the day after the election, by the way, Kenyatta.
Isn't that interesting? After the midterm elections, it totally disappeared.
Yep. It's because Republicans use fear. I mean, this is the principal thing that the right uses, and the generic right has always used fear. I mean, you could take this back to the right wingers in Greece, the right wingers in the Roman Empire. They use fear. That's their principal tool. The authoritarian governments, fear, and now you've got Fox News doing ISIS's work for them.
But is that a sustainable stratagem, Tom? I mean,
yes.
You spoke of Greece, but how did that turn out for them?
Well, you know, empires come and go, but look at the fastest growing economy in the world right now. They just surpassed the United States. It's China. That's authoritarian capitalism. That's the new model. That's, you know, and if you don't believe that American businesses support the idea of authoritarian capitalism, then just, you know, the proof of it is just look at how many of our jobs they have moved to China in, you know, embracing authoritarian capitalism. Because they can, you know, it helps them get more work done for less money. And so, anyhow, Kenyatta, thanks for the call. It's always good talking with you. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, this gets really interesting, as I was saying. Facebook says they've got this program called Deep Face, where they created an artificial intelligence program that can learn. And then they've got this, there's this database out there that, everybody uses. It's called the Label Faces in the Wild, LFW database. 13,000 photographs from around the web of 5,700 celebrities. And in different poses, different postures, different lighting, different expressions on their face. Because facial recognition has been a real challenge for computers up until now. Because if you open your mouth, your face changes. If you smile, your face changes. If you open your eyes wide, your face changes. If you squint, your face changes. I mean, there's all these, we've got all these muscles on our face. And all of them produce changes in the ratios and proportions that a computer would see if it was trying to match one face to another. Which is why mugshots were always face forward, face to the side, don't open your mouth. You know, it's a, you try to make it as simple as possible. But now what they're doing is they're teaching these computers how to learn. And this deep face project at Facebook has reached the point, apparently, where they're about as good as we are. This article in today's Science magazine, sciencemag.org. Catapulting the California-based company beyond other corporate players in the field, Facebook's deep face system is now as accurate as a human being at a few constrained facial recognition tasks. The intention is not to invade the privacy of Facebook's more than 1.3 billion active users, insists Yan LeCun, a computer scientist at New York University in New York City who directs Facebook's artificial intelligence research, but rather to protect your privacy. Once DeepFace identifies your face in one of the 400 million new photos that users upload to Facebook every day, quote, you will get an alert from Facebook telling you that you appear in the picture. You can choose to blur out your face in the picture to protect your privacy. Oh, isn't that sweet? They're going to let me know if somebody uploads a picture with me in it. And now you know what I look like in all dimensions and all under all circumstances wherever I am. And at what point does Facebook start sharing this information with, say, the police or the FBI or Bank of America? So that they can, you know, for your credit score, they can start saying, okay, well, you know, does this guy go to the bar too often? I mean, they may already know that just from looking at your credit card. And yes, they are compiling those things, and they put them into categories for you. Isn't that nice? At the end of the year, you get this nice little summary. Here's how much you spent on restaurants. Here's how much you spent on your bar tab. Here's how much you spent on hotels. Here's what you spent on household goods. Here's what you spent, you know. Right. You think that information is there because I want it? I already know how much I spent in restaurants, broadly speaking. That information's there because it's marketable. It makes my name more valuable when they sell that, when they sell my name. Hey, here's a guy who eats out 3 days a week. Market to him your food products. And all of this you could argue is, you know, fine, you know, well and good as long as they're just using it to market it to you, but it's not going to end there. It never does. And I'm telling you, the new model for capitalism. Mark my words. The new model for capitalism in the United States and around the world. This is what Germany is imposing on Greece. It's what the billionaires want to impose on you and me. The new model for capitalism is the model for capitalism that was pioneered by Singapore, that was picked up by China. Deng Xiaoping went to Singapore and said, how does this work? You're rich here. But the guy who's running Singapore has been, you know, one family's been running Singapore for 40 years. And anybody who stands up to them gets slapped down. I just suggested in a public meeting in Singapore in the late 90s that people should get politically active if they don't think their schools are good enough. And they came and trashed my hotel room. The police. It's their way of saying, we're watching you. Authoritarian capitalism really works well. Capitalism in an authoritarian regime where people can't vote Gee, recently looked at, for example, in Florida, where you've got 600,000 African-Americans who can't vote because of a felony conviction, 400,000 of them in North Carolina. Keeping people in subjection, removing from them any ability to have a say over their own future and the nature and fate and future of their own government, stripping people of that, and then using them for labor and exploiting their desires to serve the economy. Authoritarian capitalism has a long history here in the United States. It was called the company town. Tennessee Ernie Ford sang a song about, oh my soul, the company town, or the company store. And it's like what we used to do here in the United States. These authoritarian capitalists, they would literally buy a town. Got a coal mine there, got a steel mill there, whatever they have. And when you come in, you're paying rent to the company that you're working for. You're buying your food from the company you're working for. And if you get out of line, the company you're working for will make you homeless. It's authoritarian capitalism. It nearly took over the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century. The guys who snatched democracy back from the jaws of authoritarian capitalism in 1901 through 1910 roughly, were Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. Republicans. Progressives, but Republicans. And then the authoritarian capitalism raised its ugly head again in 1929. Well, throughout the 20s, really, with the election of Harding in 1920 and his coming to power in 1921 and dropping the top tax rate on the billionaires from 95% down to 25%, kicking off the roaring 20s, which were not roaring for average working people. Poverty was huge in the United States in the 20s. But the rich got really rich. Here we are again.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
You really have to understand this. What Henry Wallace said was right. They want to control both the marketplace and the government because the government is the only thing that can check the power of the marketplace. Welcome back, John Harvin, here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. Just one final note on feudalism, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. When I wrote Unequal Protection back in 1999, 2000, whatever the year was that I wrote this book, actually it took me about 2 years to write it. I read a book by a fellow by the name of Mark Bloch, who is one of the world's most eminent authorities on feudalism. And his book is called Feudal Society. He's one of the great 20th century scholars of feudal history of Europe. And he writes, in almost every case, both with European feudalism and feudalism in China, South America, and Japan, quote, feudalism coincided with a profound weakening of the state, particularly in its protective capacity. Got this? The one thing that can push back against concentrated wealth, the wealth of feudal lords, the wealth of corporate masters, the wealth of billionaires, the one thing that can hold that wealth in check or push back against it on behalf of the average working person is the state. And this is why conservatives constantly talk about how much they hate big government, because big government is the only thing that can constrain big banks, big chemical companies, big AI companies, big telco companies, big transportation companies, big airlines, big pharmaceutical companies, big food combines, big fast food. I mean, you name it, big retailers. The only thing that can hold back all these big sectors of our economy so that they don't just trample the average working person is government, big government. Because the bigger the billionaire sector is, the bigger the government that's going to hold them in check has to be. And right now, it's not big enough to hold them in check. You've got the Koch brothers creating their own political party for all practical purposes. So Mark Bloch writes, feudalism coincided with a profound weakening in the state, particularly in its protective capacity. He said, whether the power and wealth agent that takes the place of government is a local baron, lord, king, or corporation, if it has, this is actually my writing in Unequal Protection, if it has greater power in the lives of individuals than does a representative government, that culture has dissolved into feudalism. Bluntly, Block states, the feudal system, quote, the feudal system means the rigorous economic subjection of a host of a humble folk to a few powerful men. End of quote. Doesn't mean the end of government, but instead the subordination of government to the interests of the feudal lords. As Mark Block, the expert on feudalism, wrote, the concept of the state never absolutely disappeared in feudal Europe. And where it retained the most vitality, men continued to call themselves free. Back to my writing in Unequal Protection, I wrote, the transition from a governmental society to a feudal society is marked by the rapid accumulation of power and wealth in a few hands, with a corresponding reduction in the power and responsibilities of government. Once the rich and powerful gain control of the government, I wrote this 16 years ago, once the rich and powerful gain control of the government, they turn it upon itself, usually first eliminating its taxation processes as it applies to themselves. As Mark Block, the scholar of these things, said, quote, nobles need not pay taxes. And as I pointed out in the book, now this is just how bizarre it's gotten. Keep in mind, I wrote this book in 1999, 2000. This was before the George W. Bush presidency, which put Reaganomics on steroids and wildly exacerbated on unequal incomes. You know, he had huge tax cut for billionaires. But here's what I wrote in 1999. Bringing this to today, consider that in 1982, just before the Reagan supply-side tax cut, the average wealth of the Forbes 400 was $200 million each. $200 million? Really? The Forbes 400? Just 4 years later, their average wealth was $500 million each, aided by massive tax cuts. Today, those 400 people, this is in 1990, own wealth equivalent to one-eighth of the entire GDP of the United States. Well, today, in 2015, those 400 people own wealth equal to one-half of the American population's wealth. That's how bad it's gotten and how fast it's gotten there. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Number 51, he wrote, in a society under the forms in which the stronger faction can readily unite and oppress the weaker, anarchy may be truly said to reign. And under such circumstances, eventually even the most powerful factions or parties will be gradually induced by a like motive to wish for a government which will protect all parties, the weaker as well as the more powerful. So Alexander Hamilton suggesting that there's a cycle to this. The feudalists rise up. They gain control of the average working person. They basically strangle them economically, politically, and using force. And then using that force, they expand their own power and wealth. Are we there yet? I would say we've been there since mid-90s. In a really serious way. We just didn't realize it. I mean, arguably, we've been there since 81, 82, and we just didn't realize it. Because Reagan planted all the seeds for the rise of a feudal elite. And that feudal elite is now reaching out and has already taken control of one entire political party in the United States and is taking a good bite out of the other. This is astonishing. Larry in Covington, Georgia. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call, and I'm so glad to be talking to the smartest man on radio.
Well, thank you, Larry. What's up?
I really feel that from my heart. You have more information to just blow your head open. But what I was going to say is, are there not any billionaires, the oligarchy, any billionaires that are good? And if they are, why don't they ever put money to counteract some of this stuff to the level where it could be at least a fair fight?
Well, there are. There are some very socially conscious billionaires, and by and large, the few of them are funders of the Democratic Party. You get Tom Steyer, who put $50 million into the last election. He's a Wall Street billionaire, but he's putting money in to challenge candidates who deny climate change. George Soros used to be fairly politically active. I don't believe he is any longer, but he was, you know, he supported the candidacy of Obama, if I recall correctly, and has, you know, has supported some think tanks, groups like Demos and things. So there, you know, and there are some good billionaires on the left. It's just that the difference is, and this is the problem, Larry, when if you're really rich and you want to get more rich, then you want your taxes to be cut. You want your regulations to be cut so that you don't, you know, you're not burdened by these, you know, bothersome things like, hey, you can't just dump poison into the air or water. And so you invest in Republican politicians and you invest $1 million and you'll make back $10 million. In some cases, some investments in buying politicians produce over 1,000% return or 1,000-fold return, a 10,000% return. Whereas if you are a liberal billionaire and, you know, like Tom Steyer, he spent $50 million electing Democrats who want to raise Tom Steyer's taxes. Well, Tom Steyer's smart enough to figure out that that's a good thing both for him and for his country. He doesn't want to be a rich man in a poor country. But a lot of billionaires are not smart enough to figure that out and or not inclined or they just don't care. And that's the problem. So, you know, Larry, thank you for the call and thanks for raising a really good topic. Dan in Great Lakes, Illinois. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Once again, God bless you for the work that you do. In answer to Larry, the previous caller, there was a segment on 60 Minutes where they did a segment on this company called SAS, SAS Institute. The CEO, his name was Jim Goodnight. It's a software business, and it will just blow your socks away when people with money and clout decide to treat their employees like they're human beings. SAS Institute. Tom, to feudalism.
Yeah. Very quickly.
Former Senator Fred Thompson appears in a commercial where he's peddling reverse mortgages.
Right.
And he leaped off with saying this idea had its beginnings in the Reagan administration. Houses used to be legacy. You would pass these things down to your children or to the next generation. And now when people are at their most vulnerable in their adult lives, they are voluntarily, because of struggle, signing over a lifetime of work and wealth back to the oligarchs.
You're right.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah, well, you said it very well, Dan. Thank you a lot. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. You're right. And, you know, reverse mortgages for a small group of people are actually probably useful lifesavers, but they're also very profitable for the banksters, which is why Fred Thompson is out there pitching. We'll be back 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We will do that. We'll be right back in just a moment. Oh, by the way, check out GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Ellen has hearts. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff watching Free Speech TV in Felicity, Ohio. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm fine. What's on your mind?
I'm just wondering, why are you the only liberal or Democrat that can see the crash coming?
I'm not the only liberal who can see the crash coming.
Well, you're one of the only ones, because Obama and all the mainstream Democrats sit out there and tout how great this economy is and how great everything's doing. And in reality, it's the same as George Bush.
Yeah. Thank you. Danielle, can you go back in and X out Jeff so he can't be put back on the air accidentally again? My apologies for the obscenity slipping through there. But, you know, we've got caller ID, so he will not make it through again. Randy in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Randy, what's up? Thanks for listening,
Tom. I think the title of your next book should be The Company Store, because that's exactly what we're dealing with now on a national and even a world level.
Yeah.
And as some of the previous callers brought up, you know, by the time you live your life and then when it comes at the end of your life, they do the reverse mortgage and the medical bills, and most of us average people die with nothing, broke.
Yeah. Yeah.
And absolutely, we have nothing to pass on to our children. And I wanted to say, you know, what I'm doing, what I've suggested a lot of people do that are my age, I'm 64, is pass on your money now. Because if you don't give it to your kids, you're going to give it to the corporatocracy or to the medical people or to the bankers.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And you can give It used to be $10,000. I think now it's up to like $14,000 per kid per year, tax free, if you have it. So there's ways to do that.
Yeah, and you know, you do have to trust your kids, you know. But you know, it's like if you hold on to your money till the bitter end, then it's just going to be lost.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I agree. And Randy, I think that's you know, well said, and a message my kids would probably love to hear. Thank you, Randy. I appreciate the call, and you know, what you have to say, I think is significant and consequential. So. Anyhow, we're in just a moment, Ellen Ratner is going to be joining us. But I want to go back to this. Facebook will soon be able to ID you in any photo. Okay. And on top of that, this is the principal way that they make money, is selling information about you. Well, that's, you know, that's business. But what happens when business gets in bed with, and we're seeing this with the phone companies, for example, AT&T giving it back door to the NSA. What happens when business gets in bed with authoritarian governments? The most successful capitalist economies on earth right now are Singapore and China. This is authoritarian capitalism. Capitalism works best in a semi-fascist environment. Capitalism works best when the people are absolutely paralyzed. Their political power is zero. Because the only thing that can hold back the power of capital, of aggregated capital, the only thing that can restrain the billionaires, the oligarchs, the only thing that can defend the average working person against the power of billionaires or trillion, you know, multi-billion dollar corporations, the only power that can do that is the power of the state, the power of government. And that's why big oil, big steel, big ag, you name it. That's why they all love to talk about how awful big government is, because big government is the only thing that can constrain them, that can restrain them from destroying your life and mine. We'll be back with Ellen Ratner. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what's going on in the world. This Ellen Ratner brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Where you can, it's not too late to get your Swarovski crystal. You buy these crystals on your own nickel. You fly them over to South Sudan. You take them yourself in your purse. And you give them to women who have seen someone killed in front of them.
We call it our beating and breathing program.
And this is a PTSD program that you put together. Extensive background in mental health. You know what you're doing. And now people can buy these crystals. And as a way of supporting these women who have are suffering from PTSD in South Sudan.
That's right. And it's not too late. Valentine's Day is around the corner. We can get this right to you.
Cool.
And three sizes.
And nobody makes a penny on this.
Nobody makes a penny.
Ellen Ratner, because you're buying the crystals, you're losing money.
Right. Exactly. I am. But it's good for the women.
Yeah. There you go. Okay. So what's going on in the world?
Well, I almost fell off my chair today when I heard the Senate Armed Services Committee, now controlled by a Republican, Jeff Sessions of Alabama, and he said he called Guantanamo a humane institution.
Really?
I'm speechless, Dr. Tom.
Yeah.
And so
it's a torture center. I mean, it's
you and I know that. Yeah. My brother's been involved in that. I mean,
have been killed there.
They've asked Talk Radio News to come down and see what we're doing, and I said not unless we can talk to the prisoners and walk around unfettered, which of course they won't let anybody. They won't even let members of Congress interview the prisoners.
Wow.
I mean, give me a break.
Yeah.
So the principal deputy undersecretary of defense actually spoke about this today. He said President Bush worked towards closing Guantanamo, and many officials in administration work hard towards that objective. He said we're closer than most people realize. He said we believe the issue is not whether to close Guantanamo. The issue is how to do it. Pretty unbelievable. And he said it's also hard to overstate how damaging the continued existence of the detention facility at Guantanamo has been and continues to be. It's a critical national security issue.
It's the number
one recruiting. But the Republicans want to keep it open.
I know. It's the number one recruiting tool for ISIS. Well, Fox News now has, you know, they're running ISIS propaganda videos on their website.
Yeah, well, okay. You know, I work for Fox News.
I know, but it's they're in bed with ISIS.
Also, Lindsey Graham, I believe it was on Fox News today, but I'm not 100% sure, but he did. I have heard the clip. He said Obama is sitting on the sidelines in the Middle East crisis.
dropping bombs, running drones.
Yeah, I mean, how is that sitting on the sidelines?
I wish he was sitting on the sidelines.
Oh, you and me both. Okay. Some other interesting things. The Pope is going to be coming to Washington, D.C. in September.
Holy cow, we've got the Dalai Lama here today.
We do. We're going to talk about that in a second. He is going to be addressing a joint session of Congress on September 24th, 2015. Obviously, I don't know whether Speaker Boehner invited him and checked with the State Department or just invited him, but that's the story. Now, Nancy Pelosi may skip the Netanyahu address. She said at this point she plans to go, but she says, as of now, I'm going, but you never know about people's schedules.
Right.
That's actually what the White House said yesterday about the Netanyahu and the vice president's visit. Well, the vice president has only missed one joint session of Congress, but, you know, they're working on his schedule. But, of course, they don't want to look like they're influencing the Israeli elections with Netanyahu, which is why the president isn't meeting with him. Well, then how about the vice president going? Well, it depends on his travel schedule.
Right.
And, you can bet there's going to be some trip.
And whether there's, like, you know, a really good turkey club down in the vice president's private dining room or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
he'll come up with an excuse.
Okay, now. Shock of all shock, the Republicans have now announced an Obamacare alternative.
Yeah, it's based on tax cuts, right?
Well, that's right. It's now called the CARE Act, Choice, Affordability, Responsibility, and Empowerment. It will allow children to stay on their parents' insurance plans until they're 26. However, individual states can opt out of this, which means there's lobbying on that level. They also are allowing a sign up, but it's a one-time sign up. So instead of having an every year, like an open enrollment period, it's a one-time sign up.
So after that, you're toast.
And most people are not aware that on the Medicare sign up, if you do not sign up, I think it's Part B, when you turn 65 or the 3 months before, whenever you sign up during your, right before your 65th year, and you don't sign up then, you can't sign up.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know.
No, for Medicare you can, but not for one of the parts. There's A, B, C, and D, I guess.
Wow.
And most people are unaware of that.
Wow.
You got to, you know, strike while the iron's hot. Well, that's exactly what the Republicans want on this one. They said our nation's health care system was broken before Obamacare, and the president's health care debacle has only made things worse. I mean, that's what they're saying now. Well, you got to say this. They did come up with a plan. I've been moaning and groaning. Where's the Republican plan if they're going after Obamacare?
Right.
Pretty unbelievable.
Yeah.
Okay. California now wants to add the personal belief exemption for vaccinations. They've had it for a while. As you know, Disneyland had an outbreak of measles. I was just in California. It's top of all the newspapers. Yep. They are saying that they do believe that this personal belief exemption has got to go away. Governor Jerry Brown says that he will sign it. Apparently, there's been 100 people and has even gone into New Mexico.
Yeah, you can maintain herd immunity with less than 1% not vaccinated. But when you get above 1%,
more of that, you're in big trouble. We've seen this in South Sudan.
Yeah.
I've seen it with polio. Do you want everybody to get polio? I mean, or not everybody, but all you need in terms of health care costs is for 2%, 1% to get polio. And our health care costs are going to skyrocket, not even what happens to somebody's life.
Yeah. But Louise's grandmother had polio. She had her left arm was withered throughout her life.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, when I grew up, kids had polio.
Yeah, me too. I remember a lot of adults who'd had polio, who limped or like grandma, you know, couldn't use her
left. I remember when I was in junior high school, we picked up a friend of a friend to go to a movie, and she sort of ran, skipped to the car so nobody would be able to tell that she actually had one withered leg.
Wow. Well, it was Franklin Roosevelt had polio.
Of course, and nobody talked about it. He was carried to places.
Yeah.
All right, sort of last but not least, oh, well, actually, I got a couple things, but the president did speak at the annual prayer breakfast. He welcomed the Dalai Lama. You know, China said there should be no communication with the Dalai Lama.
He welcomed him?
He did welcome
Holy
him.
Cow!
Yes.
And the Dalai Lama, Awakening and Compassion in Action, two movies about the Dalai Lama that I'm in, narrated by Harrison Ford, are opening tonight in New York City at 6:30 at the Village East Cinema. You can get more information at DalaiLamaFilm.com. Ellen, thank you very much.
It.
There you go.
Thank
Goats you. For the Old Goat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Linda Greenhouse, since 1978, has been covering the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe, for the New York Times. She's writing in today's New York Times about this case, King v. Burwell. This, I'm still on my terror here about neo-feudalism, modern feudalism, neo-fascism, corporatism, whatever you want to call it, the death, authoritarian capitalism. Basically, the death of democratic institutions. The only thing that can constrain big capital is big government. And our government right now is not big enough to restrain big capital, which is why the really big capital, the Koch brothers with their $80 billion, they're going to throw almost $1 billion into the next election cycle, they and their buddies. This is not what Thomas Jefferson had in mind. I mean, he explicitly said so a number of times. So where do we go with this? The American Postal Workers Union announced today, this is a 200,000 member organization. This is in the New Hampshire Labor News. Omaha Steve posted it over at Democratic Underground. They announced that the organization will vigorously oppose the merger of Staples and Office Depot. Why? Well, first of all, this is a multi-billion dollar takeover or merger. 17 years ago, during the Clinton administration, the Justice Department looked at Staples and Home Depot merging and said that would create a monopoly. We're not going to allow that. Occasionally they do this. I realize, you know, Reagan effectively stopped. He didn't really stop enforcing the Sherman Act. What he did was he lowered the bar so far that pretty much anybody could become a monopoly. And that's still where that bar is to a large extent. This administration is inclined to let Staples and Office Depot merge. I mean, we'll see. But here's the kicker for the postal workers. As New Hampshire Labor News writes, in the past year, over the objections of the American Postal Workers Union, consumer organizations, civil rights advocates, and teachers groups, Staples has begun offering mail services in its retail stores. In doing so, Staples has replaced highly trained U.S. Postal Service workers with its own unskilled, low-wage employees. At the same time, concurrently, the United States Postal Service has reduced hours in some post offices and encouraged customers to go to the Staples stores instead. Mr. Diamondstein, the representative of the Postal Workers Union, or leader of it, says the transfer of living wage jobs to low wage poverty level jobs is not in the public interest. Staples is an anti-worker corporation, and we don't want to see its reach expanded. We will vigorously oppose this merger. It's bad for workers and bad for consumers. And let us not forget Staples exists because Mitt Romney helped fund it into existence. So, of course, it's a predatory corporation that screws its employees. Anyhow, with King v. Burwell, back to Linda Greenhouse. What she is saying is that the Supreme Court, under John Roberts, Antonin Scalia, Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito, under these five men, all authoritarian, hardcore, right-wing, Catholic, and all those words don't always go with Catholic, just see Pope, right? These guys have an agenda, a serious agenda. And that agenda is largely political. It's going to be very interesting to see how they decide in King v. Burwell. But the corruption of our court, keep in mind, before Citizens United, which opened the doors for the Koch brothers for all this money to pour into our system, before that ruling, Justices Scalia and Thomas were wined and dined by the Koch brothers. Now, if they were federal judges, they would have had to recuse themselves on any case that might involve the Koch brothers or rich people in general, or they never should have gone in the first place to the Koch brothers' gig to be wined and dined and applauded and feted and all that kind of stuff. But because the Supreme Court has exempted itself from the federal code of conduct for federal judges, they're free to set a horrible example. No cameras in their courtroom, no microphones in their courtroom, no dissent in their courtroom. They can decide pretty much whatever they want, however they want. Excuse me, sneezing here. And usually when one comes, more follow. So, in a whole variety of cases, and Citizens United, I think, is the most visible one. They said, okay, you know, which side of the political spectrum has the most money? Well, obviously the right. Because the whole point of the right is to defend the interests of money, whereas the whole point of the left is to defend the interests of labor. So let's change the rules of the game so money has more power. These guys live in a little insulated bubble here in Washington, D.C. They have no connection with the real world. I mean, Clarence Thomas, for years, broke the law by not disclosing his wife Ginny's income from the Heritage Foundation. About $800,000, apparently. If he was a federal judge, he'd be in jail right now. But no, he's a darling of the right. Over at Alternate, Stephen Rosenfeld writing, Koch supporting Texas billionaires explain what richest Americans are after. Now, this was a couple, Doug and Holly Deason of Dallas, Texas, who wrote an op-ed in the Dallas Morning News that was co-signed by eight other wealthy Texans who I don't know the other eight, I'm assuming, were at the Koch brothers retreat where they were raising roughly $900 million to influence the next election cycle. And they wrote an op-ed saying, we want Washington to do what it hasn't done for years, work for, not against the American people. Right. This is really what the billionaires want. They want Washington to look out for the American people. Really? Elaine Marshall, who owns 15% of Koch Industries, has a net worth of $8.8 billion, co-signed the letter. Tom Hicks, the wealthy business magnate down in Texas, the guy who was bankrolling Rick Perry last time around. As I recall, Tom Hicks, he's reduced the selling price of his home down to $60 million if you want to buy a new home in Texas. He said, I don't think I'm out of line, nor is anyone, to question the motive or message when so much money and effort lays under the surface. Right. They wrote, what we want is an impartial, accountable, efficient, and limited government. Texas shows this is possible, but Washington looks like nothing we've described. Texas, land of the death penalty, land of the 1 million people who are so poor that they can't get Obamacare. They can't get Medicaid because Rick Perry won't expand the program. The state that has virtually outlawed abortion everywhere. Texas, where, you know, the fastest job growth of low-wage, minimum-wage, starvation-wage jobs in the country. Good-paying jobs? No, not so much. Not in Texas. Forget that. Don't even go to Texas if that's what you're doing. These billionaires, right, special interests have never been more powerful in Washington. Right. The guys who are going to spend $900 million on politics are worried about special interests? Really?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In short, they write, Washington is broken, and it's harming the American people and destroying our country's future. Simply look around you. Yes, look at the billionaires. Welcome back. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind?
Hi, Dr. Tom. I understand you've already had some discussions of the TPP, which I missed, but I was wondering, why is it legal for a foreign country to come over here to the United States and present a trade agreement and have it classified so that the people of the United States cannot read it before it is forced down our throats? And why can they keep it classified when people keep asking, what is it? I've heard that it will actually make us a province under the world court, and that we have to honor and respect other countries' traditions, which would also include, you know, things that would violate as
authoritarian capitalism, slave labor. Yes, we have to honor those traditions. There is no world court that the SHAFTA, the TPP, would create. Instead, what they will create are tribunals, just like NAFTA did, where corporate lawyers who serve as prosecutors in these tribunals take turns serving as judges in these tribunals, where corporations around the world can sue you or me or our town or our state or our federal government if our laws reduce even the possibility of their profits. They can sue for millions of dollars, not that they lost because of our laws, but that they might lose because of our laws.
Well, I've heard that it will essentially eliminate our civil rights and that there really won't be any reason for us to have a constitution anymore. You know, there was a rather big discussion down here. And I do apologize for my senator. I'm sorry. The man doesn't call me back either. But
is that Jeff Sessions?
Yes. There's people down here who want him on the ticket as a vice president candidate. And I'm going, oh, no, please not.
Yeah. Now, Scott Walker's going to be the VP candidate. It's going to be Jeb Bush and Scott Walker, I think.
Yeah, but anyway, I've heard that this thing will eliminate civil rights, particularly for women, because there some countries' traditions have Sharia law as legal, and that this would make Sharia law legal here across the country, where they failed to have it legalized in Detroit a couple years ago, and it's now they're pushing it in Florida. And so, why can a country come over here and present a document and have it classified so that the population can't even know what they want to do to us?
Yeah. Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is not going to institutionalize Sharia law. However, that's a great way to scare the hell out of Fox News viewers.
Well, I don't know, but
Fox News is not talking about this.
Can we sue Congress to make them publish it?
No.
Is it possible?
No. No. They have.
Why not?
They have, because they have sovereign immunity. The only thing you can do is vote them out of office.
Well, I have a lot of chance of doing that. You know, we don't even have the Affordable Care Act.
You got a lot of people in Alabama. I mean, it's if you wake up five people and each one of them wakes up five people, and we got 2 years here now until the election, there's plenty of time to get this done. Norma, get started.
Well, I do a lot of talking, and when I went around talking about this, Representative Sam Johnson from Texas wanting presenting legislation to cut disability Social Security, no one else knew anything about it because our local station has football news, not regular world
news. And Fox News won't talk about that, and that's probably where most of these people are getting their news from, which is a real tragedy. Norma, thank you for the call. I share your frustration and concern. Absolutely sure. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and time for our pigeon alert.
Look, up in the sky.
It's a bird.
No, it's a plane.
We are autonomous robotic organisms from the planet Xenu.
And now, a story about a bird.
Yep, there's a pigeon pageant. It lets underappreciated birds strut their stuff. That's the Associated Press headline. Dateline Ontario, California. Dogs aren't the only animals that vie for best in show. Hundreds of breeds of pigeons compete in their own version of the Westminster Show. And I'm going, wait a minute. Everybody knows that pigeons are actually robots and the planet Xenu sent here to spy on us. So, and that's why, you know, whenever powerful people get together, what do you have in the street out in front? Pigeons. What do you have sitting in the windowsill? Pigeons. What do you have on the roof? Pigeons. Ever seen a dead pigeon? No. Ever seen a baby pigeon? No. Why is that? Because they're robots. They're sent here to spy on us. And every 6 months, the mothership from the planet Xenu comes down, and takes up the old ones, drops off the new ones, and then plays back the little tapes inside all the old ones. So I'm reading this article going, how can this be? The National Pigeon Association's 93rd Annual Grand National Pigeon Show? And then I get to this paragraph. Bob Nolan of Dana Point, a historian and 60-year member of the Los Angeles Pigeon Club, which hosted the show, said, and I quote, all of these pigeons are man-made. Oh, so we're making our own robots. None of them occur in nature like this, said Nolan, who raises English trumpeters, known for their acoustic sound of distant trumpets. All of these breeds have evolved from man's creative genius. Ah, so it's only the wild pigeons that are the robots. Okay. I got it. Good to know these things. Donald in Chicago. Hey, Donald, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi, Tom. You know, I was going to tell you something about the feudalism, but this thing that she said, one lady that you were talking about, that claims that the Republicans come up with this solution, based on what you were saying, they literally are opting, or they're giving all the states the ability to opt out of it. So that means that's going to kill it all. You know what really strikes me funny, too? They mentioned, oh, well, you know, we'll just keep the fact that you keep your kids down until they're 26 years old. But they didn't go on to mention anything about this business of dropping you if you got a catastrophic disease or not allowing you to have insurance if you have a pre-existing condition.
Right. The other thing that they're promoting, that the Republicans are in their alternative to Obamacare, is that insurance companies can sell insurance across state lines. Now, at first blush, that sounds kind of common sense. I mean, I can buy from Amazon across state lines. Why can't I buy my health insurance across state lines? It turns out that the reason why is because my purchases from Amazon are not going to end my life or save my life. But my health care might do one or the other or both. And therefore, particularly with regard to health insurance, there needs to be somebody who's looking out for my interests, who has the power of the state behind them, who is holding back, who is constraining the power of the health insurance companies. And those in every state, they're called insurance commissioners. And if you were to allow the insurance companies to sell across state lines, we went through the same thing with credit cards. Back in the 60s or 70s, they passed legislation allowing credit card companies to sell credit cards, to offer credit cards across state lines. And what happened was South Dakota had the least restrictive rules for credit card companies. You could really abuse your customers. You could charge them enormous amounts of interest. There was very little mechanism for holding them accountable in South Dakota. So what happened? If you look on your credit card, you will see that they're all from South Dakota. They all issue them in South Dakota so that they can avoid the banking regulators in the other 49 states. If they allow health insurance to be sold across state lines, some state will declare itself the state that has the least regulations for health insurance companies, where it's easiest for health insurance companies to screw the average person, and all the health insurance companies will move to that state, and 49 insurance regulators, 49 insurance regulators around the country who are protecting you and me will be out of business. Anyhow, yeah. That's what they're up to. Donald, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Peter, in driving through Indiana. Hey, Peter, what's up? Thanks for listening to Sirius.
Hey, Tom. Well, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. With the oligarchs taking over and establishing the new feudal system, why do you suppose they're also at the same time talking people into stockpiling guns and ammunition? I mean, isn't at some point people aren't going to have jobs, they aren't going to have a place to live, they aren't going to have food, but they will have a big box of guns and ammunition.
Right. Yeah, it's the gun issue is a wedge issue. In order for the Republican Party to win elections, they can't do it just on, hey, we're here for the billionaires and the rich guys and the big corporations. They can't do it on that. So they have to come up with other topics. So they say, hey, we're here because we hate gay people, or hey, we're here because we're going to suppress the black vote, or we're here, or the Republicans will say, you know, we're here because, you know, you don't want your gun taken away from you. And so, A, it's a wedge issue that helps Republicans get elected. B, the oligarchs know that no matter how many guns Americans have in their hands, that's not going to protect Americans from either an oppressive state or an oppressive corporation. Corporation can destroy your life economically. They don't need guns. The state can do the same thing. And if the state comes in with guns and you want to try and take them on with guns, you're going to be toast. So, you know, they really don't care. It's, you know, is how many guns people have. They don't send their kids to public schools. They don't go to public theaters where you know, somebody like James, what's his name, the crazy guy, shot it up in Aurora, Colorado. So, you know, for them, it's easy. Why not? Hey, it's a wedge issue.
Possible long-term game of them setting it up to have their own private militias. Because when we don't have jobs, much like breaking up the Iraqi military and things like that, the people with guns still need to eat.
Well, they already have their own private militias.
Who's going to hire them?
They already have their own private militias. There are a number of private security companies in this country that provide, you know, very high quality, very expensive private security to billionaires, and there's a big demand for them. And they've got bulletproof limousines, and they fly in private jets, and they stay away from all the rest, you know, all the normal people, the little people. I mean, it's a very, very insular world. But, you know, promoting guns or not promoting guns, I mean, you know, again, ALEC, you know, Koch Brothers funded organization, invented the whole stand your ground, shoot first stuff that they pushed out to Florida with Jeb Bush eagerly putting it into law that, you know, brought us Mr. Zimmerman. And, you know, it's a wedge issue. It's just, you know, it's another industry that they're helping out. Peter, thank you for your call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with more of your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day right after this. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Craig in Ithaca, New York, listening to WNYY. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Craig.
First time I've ever called you, so I may be a little off-key. My bona fides. I've been a progressive since I was 5 years old, when I got on a school bus and people started teasing me about my last name.
Whoa.
Which has the word black in it.
Hmm.
It's an old Dutch name.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you were talking about voting in Ohio and the decimation of voter rolls,
right,
and where people get their information from and what a tragedy is. It's often Fox News. Mm-hmm. And I have been listening for years to public radio, and I find now that I can no longer listen to it except for the classical music. An example was last night when NPR did a piece on that this year it looks like there probably won't be much legislation in the states on anything to do with voting. And they interviewed a bunch of very official sounding American type organizations, people at these organizations, and among them was a statement that, one of the things that they've already put into effect is they're checking voter rolls and they're comparing voter rolls to make sure people aren't
This is Chris Kobach's thing out of the Secretary of State out of Colorado, if I'm remembering correctly. He's got 28 states, I think, involved in this thing where they all compare databases and purge people's names if they show up in more than one state.
Even if they don't have the same middle name, yes. Yeah, and so the point being that this all sounds like great news for somebody who considers himself intelligent, that NPR is relating this just matter-of-factly. And yet, if you've been educated by Tom Hartman, you realize that this is very subtle propaganda to people who consider themselves intelligent.
Yeah.
And So that's why I can no longer, I mean, and it's like NPR has become this big commercial.
Oh, yesterday morning, I was listening to NPR, and there was either yesterday or the day before, and they did a long interview with somebody from TransCanada, or somebody who was clearly a spokesman for TransCanada. They were talking about how wonderful the XL pipeline was, and every time they'd say, well, what about the argument that it won't create jobs? Well, of course it'll create jobs. Well, what about the argument it's going to, you know, add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere? Oh, no, it won't. That oil is going to come out one way or the other. Well, what about the argument that a pipeline could be a, you know, could foul the environment? Well, railroad cars are even worse. You know, they had all the talking points down, and the National Petroleum Radio person did not challenge any of them.
Exactly. No, there was no challenge at all last night. And it's just, so it's another, it's a like, become a tragedy of what used to be the commons, public radio.
Yep.
But as soon as it became, had to depend on commercial money, you know.
This was Reagan's brilliant idea. Yeah. I mean, it was, NPR was created under Johnson as you know, the BBC of the United States. And then Reagan came along and said, hey, wait a minute, this is the commons, this is government. No, you can't have that. We've got to figure out a way to make somebody to make a buck off this. And now NPR is down to about 7% of their budget is coming from government money, and the rest of it's coming from big corporations and the Koch brothers. And so guess what? Surprise, surprise. You will hear the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation. You will hear right-wing think tanks presenting biased and very often not just disingenuous but false information as if it was factual on NPR.
I agree.
And it's tragic. It's just tragic. Craig, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to WNYY, where you will hear what the real news is. Jerry in Marshall, Minnesota. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
I have a question for you, Tom.
Sure.
When they gerrymander a district, where do they get their information from?
The census.
From the census.
Yeah, the Constitution says that every 10 years, every year that ends with zero, the every state shall, or the federal government shall, do a national census, and then based on the results of that census, congressional districts shall be redrawn, reapportioned to reflect the changing population from state to state. And sometimes states gain a member of Congress, sometimes they lose a member of Congress, districts move around a little bit, and that reapportioning process, that redistricting process, when it is under the influence of political process, as it is in pretty much every state except California now, leads to what we refer to as gerrymandering, which goes back to the early days of the Republic. Mr. Eldridge Gerry, who was one of the founders, one of the co-signers of the Declaration, as I recall, maybe the Constitution. But anyhow, it goes back that far.
Okay, I was hoping that it was off of the voter registration, because then we could all register as Republican and then vote Democrat.
No, it's the census rolls. These enormous databases that are being compiled by the Koch brothers, by the Democratic Party, the Republican Party of voters, they're looking at partisan representation. But I doubt that registering with the other party would be of much help. And I don't know, in Minnesota, do you know if you have open primaries or closed primaries?
I've never been asked.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to the question. If you have, but you might want to check. I mean, it's sometimes it can be really fun registering under the opposite party, but only if you live in a state where you have open primaries, because then you get all the propaganda from them, you know, and you can push back and hassle them and whatnot. Although, you know, really in times like this, as critical as this, I think it's really important, even in an open primary state, to register as, you know, if you believe or if you feel that you are a Democrat, that that party represents your values, or at least has the potential to represent your values, that, you know, you get involved with the Democratic Party. Jerry, thanks for the call.
All right,
great.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Yeah, great to hear from you. Thanks for listening to Sirius. Dennis in Raleigh, North Carolina, listening to Sirius. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was just wondering, would it be possible to tax the campaign contributions?
Yes. The way that you do it, I mean, what's happening right now is that you've got these billionaires giving money to their own 501c3s and c4s. They're giving it to nonprofit organizations. Some, much, maybe a lot, I don't know of, because I don't know how to, you know, I'm not a CPA who does taxes for rich people. But, you know, if you've got a nonprofit involved in there, a lot of this is tax-free, which means that they're taking a tax deduction while they're buying our country, and that's pretty mind-boggling.
that's what got me thinking. If the Koch brothers are going to spend $1 billion, you would think they'd be happy to pay a couple million in taxes to pay for the stuff they're trying to get done.
Yeah, good luck with that, Dennis. Good luck with that.
Just a thought. Thanks,
but I think rather than taxing campaign contributions, what we need to do is go back to regulating them. It's very, very straightforward process. Dennis, thank you for the call. Benny, in Cape Canaveral, Florida. Hey, Benny, what's up?
Not too much, Tom.
It's on your
mind.
I'm just curious.
By the way, gerrymandering comes from Governor Jerry, who was an old-time governor of Massachusetts, which is where I'm originally from.
Yep.
And but anyway, you're always talking about the Koch brothers being the bad guys, which, of course, they are. But why aren't the banks, which are really the worst of the worst ever being mentioned? I mean, let's face it, all the austerity programs are coming from the banks.
Mm-hmm.
The debt we're paying down is we're paying the banks.
Right.
You know?
I'm with you. I'm with you, Benny. I think that these banks need to be broken up. We have too big to fail, too big to jail banks in the United States. And,
no, they don't need to be broken up. They need to be disbanded.
Yeah, that's fine.
We need to go back to debt-free money and state-owned banks.
Well, we've never been there. We had a state-owned bank, you know, twice in the history of the United States, and it didn't work out all that well.
Yeah, Andrew Jackson made the mistake when he broke up the Second Bank of America, whatever the heck the name it was.
That's what it was called, yeah.
Yeah. When he broke them up, he didn't replace it with anything. He let the states float.
Right.
If he had instituted debt-free money and started printing federal money at that time, we wouldn't be in the pickle we're in today.
Well, except that Lincoln started doing that in the 1860s. And they
shot him for it.
Well, you can make that argument. I think John Wilkes Booth and his buddies were just disgruntled Southerners.
He was in the pay of the British bankers, if you check your history. If you really go digging in, he was in the pay of the British banks.
Yeah. Well, you know,
Alexander Hamilton was in the pay of the Rothschild branch of the British family. I mean, the British Rothschild.
Well, Hamilton was pretty nakedly and openly in favor of aristocracy in the United States. He at the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia, he gave one of the first speeches, and he proposed that the president should be elected for life and referred to as His Highness. And he was laughed out of the room. He was so embarrassed and so humiliated and so angry that he went back to New York City where he lived and refused to come back for the next month during the Constitutional Convention.
I'm aware of that.
He took his marbles and went home. I mean, so.
Well,
but, yeah, back to the banking, though. Go back to community banking. Go back to banks can't operate outside of state boundaries. That would be fine with me. There are a lot of ways to regulate banks. It's just that, you know, it's going to take Congress to do it. And as long as the Republicans control Congress, the Republicans are controlled by the banksters. I mean, I realize that there are some Democrats who take money from banksters, too, far too many. But it really is the Republican Party. They are the party of the banksters. Benny, thanks for the call. Well, well said. An excellent point. Really, really worth bringing up. It is 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be right back with more of your calls right after this. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Daniel, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Arcadia, Florida. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Daniel.
I'd like to inform people about this Yacht TV, how they promote Pike's Teach Summit. But if you look at Mysteries of the Freemasons, Albert Pike was a Southern Democrat, neo-Confederate, which, if you look at the word Confederate, means counterfeit. These were like all under-the-table people who were sat on their butt and didn't want to do anything. Albert Pike, after he lost the Civil War, said, you have to worship God and Satan because he's the bearer of the light. And every day, these right-wing groups that claim that they're for Christianity, evidently they haven't read the New Testament.
Yeah, have you looked at the Republican logo lately, Daniel? They flipped the star upside down, so it's no longer the American flag star. It's now the goat, the satanic worshiper star. And it's right on their logo. I mean, it's amazing. These Republicans with their little elephant with the three upside down stars on it. It's truly astonishing. Thanks for the call, Daniel. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yeah, I just wanted to, also say that Minnesota Public Radio, which was, I think it's one of the largest public radio systems in the public radio, I guess.
Yeah, you're right.
Here.
Minneapolis, Minnesota and Boston.
WGBH. And, I've seen them evolve from, I would say, a fairly liberal institution to under Bill Kling to something that is just, they do have very articulate and intelligent speakers on in the morning. They do a talk program that's a few hours long, but they talk about nothing. There's nothing controversial. And I've brought this up before. When they had the People's Climate March, which was attended by 400,000 people just in New York City, and then there were, smaller marches throughout the whole world. So probably over, I don't know, maybe 2 million people marched on that day. And what you didn't hear anything about it on Minnesota Public Radio. You saw it in the second page of their, on their website. And the very the way that they worded it, quote unquote, was a large march for the climate was, attended, that they had one in, that's what they called it, a large march. They didn't use, they didn't say 300,000, 400,000. I mean, it's hard to, estimate, but it was anywhere from 300,000 to about to a half a million people. And Winona LaDuc addressed, United Nations, and she was, she's a prominent citizen here. No mention of her, no mention that the Rockefeller brothers were going to divest of their oil stock. It just amazes me because it started out at St. John's College. It was started by somewhat radical Benedictine monks. And Garrison Keillor is probably the most liberal product, I would say. And I'm sure he would, if he was honest enough, would probably agree with me. So I just wanted to, to say that.
Okay.
It's very frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. John, thank you for the call. I'm totally with you. National Petroleum Radio. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. George in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, George, you wanted to correct a point that Ellen made about Medicare?
Yes. I don't know if I got in on the end of the conversation. She may have addressed it, but she mentioned something about all the other parts. If you're over 65 and haven't signed up, you can't get enrolled in these parts, and that's incorrect.
Okay. What is correct?
If you have a creditable insurance at the time, whether it be COBRA or through your employer, and you're 70 years old, for example, you have a window of, I believe it's 3 to 6 months after you retire or have lost your insurance from your employer to sign up for Part B or to Part C, which is Medicare Advantage,
right.
And then Part D, which is the drug part. So I don't think she was clear on that totally.
So she was right. If you lose your insurance and you are over 65 and you don't sign up during that 3 month window when you can sign up for these other parts of Medicare, you can no longer get them. Is that correct?
No, I believe what you will end up doing is because of time lapse, you will be penalized. There'll be a surcharge. I believe it's, 10% add on for each year you don't sign up. It's not a complete picture as she described it.
Right. Okay.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, George, thank you for that. I don't know if you're right, if Ellen's right, or if it's somewhere in between the two. You sound like you're well informed on this, and I think Ellen is passingly informed. Neither Ellen nor I are old enough to qualify for it, so neither one of us have gone to the trouble of finding out all the the minutia and details, but that day will come. George, thank you for the call. Terry in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First of all, let me say I'm a liberal. I have to say that because liberal talk show hosts always accuse me of being a conservative, and I'm not. But I drive for a living, and we have passengers, we listen to your show, and they sit there and we talk, and we agree with all the things. You talk about what is needed to protect and help the middle class and the poor. But then they say, I can't vote for the people he supports because they don't believe that you have a Second Amendment right to own a gun. And that is what's killed the Democratic Party. And it's not the conservative. It is the gun controllers have prevented almost all the things you support. Because people, I heard them in 2008 who went and voted for Obama, and they said they were scared to death that Obama was going to take away their guns, but voted the same in 92. But unless it's a catastrophe, people simply will not vote for liberal ideas because they're afraid the liberals are going to take away their guns.
No, I get it, Terry. And in Vermont, which has the most, I believe, the most liberal gun control laws in the United States, when I lived in Vermont, I walked into a gun shop, and the guy was like, yeah, you can buy a gun. You can walk out of here with it in your pocket. You don't need a concealed carry permit in Vermont. You can carry a gun, you know, pretty much anywhere you want, anytime you want. Hunting season is 12 months out of the year. There's always something in season. And, you know, and Bernie has a perfect record with the NRA, I believe.
I heard Bernie Sanders on Rachel Maddow, and she brought up the gun control, and I thought he was going to fall off his seat. If we could get a Second Amendment...
But hang on just a second, Terry. There's another piece to what I was going to say, and that is that the Democratic Party is not opposed to you owning a gun. This is a lie manufactured by the Republican Party and promoted by the NRA. The closest the Democratic Party has ever gotten to this, and this is something that was started by Ronald Reagan after he was shot by John Hinckley, was an effort to control weapons of war in the civilian theater, in our cities and towns and countryside, which is the assault weapon ban. And, you know, this is Reagan's idea.
But let me tell you.
But that's not in law right now. Obama never advocated that. The Democrats, you know, they are so cowed by the NRA, they're so frightened that they're not even bringing up stuff that, you know, 80-90% of Americans think there should be an assault weapon ban. And the Democrats will not champion this.
When they go out and vote, they vote different. If you want to get your policies, what we need to do is have the Democrats put up another amendment that simply says, the Second Amendment says you have a right to own a gun, so that the left can say, we're not going to take your way of guns, and the Republicans can't say you are, because it would be in the Constitution that it clearly states that an individual...
Well, it's already there. I mean, you know, the Supreme Court in...
...getting these policies that you want passed because people won't be afraid to vote for liberal Democrats.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court has already found an individual right to own a gun in the Second Amendment. So it's not even like that needs to be put into law. It's already there. I'm telling you, Terry, the fear of Democrats with regard to guns is entirely manufactured, promoted by right-wing talk radio, promoted by Fox so-called news, promoted by the NRA, but it's and promoted by Republicans running for office. I agree with you. Democrats need to stand up and push back on this, and you know, many don't. But, you know, at the same time, Republicans of good conscience should agree with Ronald Reagan that we should ban assault weapons in the United States. These are weapons of war. There is no reason for them. There's no sports shooting reason for them. There's no hunting reason for them. There's no self-defense reason for them. That's not an unreasonable thing. And the majority of Republicans agree with that. Terry, thank you for the call. Tom in Taft, California. Tom, a little less than a minute. You got a really quick one here before the end of the show?
Sure, Tom. You know, I just, you know, before a government moves into any country, they always take out the communications, shoot out the radar dishes, all of that.
Right.
And we just had the FCC now take over the Internet.
No, it's not true.
The Internet, which...
It's the other way around, Tom. What the FCC is doing is saying we are not going to micromanage the Internet. Nobody can micromanage the Internet. We are not going to allow these companies to micromanage the Internet. So Title II, putting the Internet under Title II, is the very best thing for net neutrality and net freedom from your point of view and mine. And that's why Comcast, AT&T, and these other big companies oppose it. They oppose it because it's going to reduce their ability to screw you and me and increase their profits. What the head of the FCC is doing is absolutely spot on right. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow. And don't forget, in the meantime, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually does require all of us. It's going to work to get out there and get involved, especially when you're going up against $800 billion in Koch brothers. It's a tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.